You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hey out there in archaeology podcast land, this is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. And we have something a little different today. We're going to talk about the peopling of the Americas. Chris Webster and I will have a discussion about that. And we'll give you some of the latest thinking on the antiquity and character of the initial peopling of the Americas. And it's not what you might think. We're having a bit of a revolution in our thinking with rewriting the history books.
Welcome to the show, everybody. This is the Rock Art Podcast, and if you're hearing my voice, Chris Webster, that means that I'm talking with Alan today, and we don't have a guest on today's episode, but that's because we have a lot to talk
Chris
about.
Oh, Chris Webster,
so,
Professor
Alan,
Webster.
Alan, welcome to your show.
You're such a wonderful resource, and it's been such a blessing. We're on episode 111. I just checked back, and it's been 3 years we've been doing this. Am I correct? Man. Quite the journey.
Something like that. Yeah, it's been a while. So it's been a lot. Let me see. I can look back at the first episode.
Wow.
Yeah, it was released on June 17th, 2020.
Well, it's been very exciting. We've had people patch in from Spain, from Australia, from Southeast Asia, and Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So we can absolutely say it's an international platform. And I want to veer off from exclusive rock art discussions on this episode, on a subject that is related to what we've been speaking about. It has to do with the peopling of the Americas. How's that, Chris?
That sounds great, because I mean, there's been a lot of stuff lately in the news about news related to archaeology articles and things like that, you know, about this topic, because it's a hot topic in North American archaeology. It's one of the big unanswered questions, at least to a lot of people, that's an unanswered question. To some people, it's a very well-answered question. To others, it's not a very well-answered question. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot to discuss in this space.
Well, the evolution is, it's, I think we're in the midst of seeing a tremendous transformation, or what is called a paradigm shift. You know, for the longest time, we believe that the platform or expression called the Clovis tradition was the basement or the beginnings of the in-migration to the Americas. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like there's still people that kind of adhere to that, to be honest with you. There's, you know, definitely some proponents of that theory still.
I would have to agree. But they're getting fewer and fewer because in the last year or two, there's been some tremendous discoveries. And they consistently have been pushing back the age and character of the earliest expression of people in the Americas, both in terms of geography and in terms of the actual typology of what that expression might mean archaeologically. I think to discuss this, you kind of have to know what the issue was and what the traditional model has said. The traditional model was that there was a migration about 13,000 years ago across the Bering Straits, and peopling of the Americas was channeled through a corridor, an ice-free corridor between the glacial masses, and that the people came through, and then they had an initial, almost an explosion of archaeological expression all across the Americas, both North, Central, and South America. Mm-hmm. And uniformly, that tradition was associated with a kind of projectile point, a dart point that was fluted. It had a mass of stone taken out of its base. They were lanceolate, mainly concave base points. And this particular expression was associated with, at least in some instances, with the hunting of megafauna. Is that what you learned as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe so. That's about right.
So when you look at the projectile points called Clovis, they have an odd distribution in North America in that they are mainly concentrated in the area of the Southeast, in Texas and the American Southwest and on the plains. And as you go west, mm-hmm. the expression becomes less and less. So in other words, if you're looking for Clovis points in the far west, in the Great Basin, up into the northwestern part, the Pacific Northwest, and in California, along in the desert west in California, you can hardly find any of them. There's very few sites. They're all isolates.
No, you can't. And you know, you see that in the literature. Yeah, we actually found an isolated Clovis point in a two-track in northern Nevada, northwestern Nevada. It was in a two-track and cracked in half because somebody had driven over it. So I don't know if it had just been uncovered through time on that road, or if it had been, you know, dropped there by the hoof of a cow or something like that, or what happened. But yeah, that's on big surveys I've done across the state. That's the only one I've ever even heard of getting found. And it was just not a lot. The thing you find more of, which I think you're alluding to, that's pre-Clovis, is Western stemmed. And we see a lot more of those out here, but still not that many when you start going back that far.
So a couple of things. There's a controversy as well in the far west involving what they call concave base or basally thinned projectile points that have been called fluted points in the past.
Yeah.
And some of the archaeologists, I would say even growing evidence, seems to support that those particular points that are found in some abundance, I would say, in certain areas, are derivative of Clovis. They are not contemporaneous with Clovis, yet they are a derivative expression whereby Clovis itself is supposed to be a projectile point tradition that in the main was soft hammer percussion or percussion flake. They have these flakes that go across the face of the Clovis. They're called outrepassé, or that just going across the entire face of the point. And this particular tradition of doing that, and also the way in which they were manufactured technologically, did not use the fine pressure flaking that you find in these other places that are available. You know, in the far west, there's a, you know, concentration of them in the Great Basin. There's some in the southern San Joaquin Valley. They're found, where else are they found? They're found in the Great Basin as well. So there's all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, you know, part and parcel of sort of a related controversy surrounding what is Clovis? What's the definition of Clovis?
Right.
And what makes a Clovis projectile point? And how old was Clovis? Is it 13.5 to 12.8? Or is it up until the end of the Pleistocene?
Right.
How long did it endure, etc.? So most of the radiocarbon dates really show a very distinctive and short chronology.
Well, I feel like it's good in this segment to point out too that, you know, we're obviously talking about Native Americans, if somebody didn't get that point already, but I don't know of any Native American tribes that have traditions for their origin going back that says they migrated from Siberia. You know what I mean? All of their traditions say they basically started here. They sprung up in North America, South America, wherever the tribe is, and that they came here. So, and I think that's an important point, that they don't have it in their oral traditions that they migrated. And I'm going to bring that up a little bit later with an article I read just a few days ago that's going to come into play there. But that's interesting to me that there's nothing about that. And do you know if there's anybody, any tribes or traditions or even rock art for that matter from like the Inuit and, you know, up in Alaska in that area where they do have traditions of migration across or across the Bering Straits?
No, I think you're right. I think that that particular scenario, that set of oral traditions, is certainly infrequent, if not absent completely.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is interesting. Now, one of the things we ought to talk about with that corridor, which is rather important, mm-hmm. is it wasn't really open until about, I would say, in the neighborhood of 14,000 years ago. So to move along that land bridge and to get into North America, you had to move through an ice-free corridor, and that ice-free corridor wasn't open until 14,000 years ago.
Right.
So again, that supported the particular model of Clovis being the first people that came into the Americas. Made sense, right?
It does make sense. And I got to say, to be honest, I hate to see what that corridor would have looked like, because after being covered by ice and then now melting ice and just soggy tundra, you know, I mean, there's definitely like forests and things like that in northern Canada, but going down through the ice-free corridor, I mean, I've been in that part of Canada, Calgary, Alberta.
Yeah.
It is flat. It would have been difficult to navigate being a soggy, probably full of tiny little lakes and ponds, you know, land. So that would have been tough. It would have been a journey.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah,
they've done studies on the biogeography within that corridor. And there was, you know, megafauna moving up into that corridor,
sure.
including, you know, bison, et cetera, and probably a lot of waterfowl. So that does make some sense to follow the herds of game and to associate with that. I think with that, we should sort of close out this first piece of the discussion. And the next discussion, we'll move into some other related matters. How's that?
Sounds good.
See you in the flip-flop, gang.
Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 111. And I'm talking to Alan about the peopling of the Americas and what kind of evidence we really have around that and how far back this evidence goes. So let's talk about some of the more hard evidence to pre-Clovis sites that we do have in this country, and notably up here in the Western United States.
And the Pacific Northwest is where I think much of this original material has come from. There's at least two sites that have very robust evidence, meaning what they have is sealed deposits that have, you know, incredibly good stratigraphy with many, many, many dates and an associated assemblage that's different from Clovis. So in other words, what we found now is a stratum, archaeological, you know, sort of an assemblage of deeply buried or chronologically specific materials that I would say started about 14,000 years ago, but go back to maybe as much as 20 or 21,000 years ago, and that are well dated. Now, when I say well dated, there's, you know, multiple dates, all kinds of dates, radiocarbon dates, plus they're sealed deposits that are buried under mesama ash or other volcanic ash that's been dated.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is instead of finding Clovis points, there's an absence of Clovis points and a presence of what we're calling Western stemmed points. They look like the other points that are called Western stemmed. And people had thought early on that the Western stemmed points were in fact the basal occupation in the Americas. But that particular perspective went by the by with the growing evidence for Clovis. But now we go full circle and we have, you know, lots of evidence now, mainly from the Pacific Northwest, but also from South America at Monteverde, for sealed deposit and these Western stem projectile points. We don't have much more. We don't have a full picture of what was going on. But first of all, what's happening here is that the way in which the channel or the method of migration from the old world to the new would no longer have been terrestrial. And that's, quite a transformation in thinking.
Yeah.
Because 14,000 years ago, that corridor was blocked. So what we're talking about is a maritime expression that came pre-Clovis and brought people to the Americas, which is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and we always talk about Americas plural, right? Because we're talking about North America, South America, Central America, all the Americas, right? And that's the thing that always kind of gets me too is, you know, we talk about, okay, so they, you know, we have solid evidence of people in the Pacific Northwest 14,000 years ago, right? That's, and maybe even a little bit older, but solid evidence going back 14,000 years. But we also have very similar evidence going back a similar time frame down in South America. And it's like, okay, well, they didn't come down here and then walk 8,000 miles to get to South America in the span of like, you know, a generation. So
either they
came here way earlier than we thought and migrated throughout the Americas and eventually made it down all the way through South America, or they came over in different ways at different times using different methods. Right.
Right. So that's the other thing that's become rather manifest is that there must have been multiple origin points throughout the continents of how they came in and where they came in and when they came in. There also must have been different traditions in terms of what they were focused upon. In some areas, it appears, and there's been arguments tendered, that the Pacific Northwest may have been a very logical place to sort of enter North America following some of the riverine corridors and other ways, because there was a lot of lakes, a lot of lacustrine, and they're looking at a lot of the waterfowl, and the waterfowl would probably have been just innumerable, just masses and masses of birds. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. It would have been certainly a resource that would have been plentiful, you know, not only that, but, you know, fish and other things you just find near those marine and like you said, lacustrine environments. I mean, it's just an abundance of things to eat. So
it would
have been easy.
Yeah. So if you're looking for things to eat, if what we've found, even at the 10,000 year benchmark, when people live near lakes and rivers, they tend to go for the low-lying fruit. What do they eat, Chris, if they're looking for food near lakes or rivers?
I mean, I would say fish and berries and things like that. What are we looking at?
Well, what they do is they, you know, those that have cattails and tubers and those bulbous things they can pull out of the ground.
Indeed.
They're not very lively in terms of being hugely, you know, nutritious. But you know what? They'll give you a full belly. So when you pull them up, you can pound them. You can roast them. You can do whatever you want to do with them. And you'll have a full meal. And it didn't take you long to acquire it. So when they're looking at coprolites from 10,000 years ago, they're full of these tubers and these bulbs from those lacustrine, you know, vegetation, because they're easy to harvest.
That makes sense.
And they will fill you up calorically, and also you get the waterfowl.
Yeah. And it makes you wonder why they even left at all and kept migrating.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think when they found those lakes and rivers, they found a windfall. And so they could live there for quite a while. And maybe they were there for quite a while.
Yeah.
At those places in the Pacific Northwest, they've got 14, 15, 16,000 year old dates. Now, what I've heard off the record, but somewhat, you know, not sort of a, you know, sort of as an aside, there appears to be some dates for Daisy Cave on the Channel Islands that may go back 16, 17,000 or more years ago. Hmm. And if that is the case, then that's another example of watercrafts, a maritime economy. They came there and they stayed, and they obviously came there in boats and lived and, you know, took advantage of the resources such as they were on those islands.
You know, I wonder if they really date to 16,000-17,000 years. I don't know how deep that channel is between, like, you know, the Long Beach area and the Channel Islands.
Right.
I mean, the water would have been much lower because, you know, a lot of it was still sucked up into the ice caps. So
yep.
I wonder, they couldn't have necessarily walked to the Channel Islands, I'd imagine, but it would have been a heck of a lot shallower and a smaller expanse to traverse by boat.
Yeah. And you could always traverse that area in a boat. They do right now, even at this point.
Oh, sure.
It's not that far away. And if you've got the islands, you've also got the coast there to add to your repertoire in terms of subsistence. So it's interesting, nonetheless. One of the things people talk about a lot, which is kind of related to this thinking, is that there's a type of an artifact called a crescent. And it's just sort of a stone piece that kind of looks like a crescent moon. And it's only about as big as my thumb or in that realm. And there's hundreds, thousands of them scattered mainly always in lacustrine environments around lakes and other water sources. And so there's been an extensive argument made that because of their distribution, that they may have been associated with the hunting of waterfowl. Have you heard that?
No, I don't have much knowledge from that down in that area, but that's pretty interesting. Yeah.
What they have hypothesized is that they were attached to arrows as bunts, transverse projectile points. In other words, kind of so that they would knock the animals out of the sky, and then they would harvest them and kill them, like the geese and the swans and the ducks. And yeah. Also, during certain times of the year, the waterfowl would congregate and they would lose the ability to fly. And you could simply net them in huge numbers and then harvest them. Yeah, yeah. The grebes are one example of that. Those are those, you know, kind of funny little birds that sit on the lakes and are brown or black. And that's what happens.
Wow, that's cool.
So that's a whole other aspect of this exercise. The locations in the Pacific Northwest of where those sites are seem to be a channel along the Columbia River. And that would be a logical sort of inlet for these the in-migration to occur. You know, it's interesting. I guess I could share this too. I hadn't thought about it now, but since I'm working in this area, et cetera. Using obsidian hydration dating, okay? We've talked about that often. It's the volcanic glass can be used to date. You can take a thin section out of it and it picks up water. And the thickness of that band is an artifact, a measure, a calendar of its age. Hmm. In the Pacific Northwest and in California, they've done tremendous amounts of work on calibrating the ages of all the different obsidian sources. And they've done source-specific temperature-adjusted obsidian hydration dating. So they've gotten it more and more refined, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the ages of the largest rimmed artifacts from the various quarries, they go back 16 and 17,000 years old.
Wow.
There aren't very many of them that go back to that age, but there are those rims and they are that size. And we have found them both in the archaeological record up in Oregon and in California. So if that measure was accurate, here's a testament to the antiquity of the occupation and the initial use of those areas. Does that make any sense?
That does. And I think with that, we'll take our final break because I've definitely got some questions about that on the other side back in a minute. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 111. I'm Chris Webster discussing the peopling of the Americas with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. And we're coming up to the end of the show here. So let's round out this discussion. And one of the things you were saying just, you know, in the last segment there, when you were talking about the dates on the obsidian hydration on some of those things dating back, you know, 16, 17,000, but you said not very many. And I'm like, okay, but if we have like even one thing that is concrete evidence that is indisputable, that is, yes, this is here. I mean, isn't that an open and shut case? Like, what is it going to take all the naysayers to say, yes, things now, here's the new date. This is it. This is, we definitely have evidence going back this far. You know, when can we close the lid on that and say, yep, this is it.
I think as we get growing evidence, and as we get the various orders of evidence from different data sets and different sites, it's becoming a compelling and substantive story. And so it's one that is it's difficult for us to rewrite history, but it's being rewritten as we speak, because, you know, we've spent how many years telling the story one way, and this totally turns the discussion on its head, both from its dating, its placement, the fashion that it was, that people came in, everything about it is different, I would say. Don't you agree?
I do.
I mean, it's different. It's yeah.
I do. And
okay, go ahead.
But please. That's the thing, though. It's like, you know, you use these tried and true dating methods. We're not using like wacky off the wall dating methods to date some of this older stuff, right? We're using tried and true dating methods that have been used across the world and that people believe and trust when it comes to things like Europe. And you say, oh, this dates to 25,000 years ago. And they're like, yep, that seems legit. I buy it, because Europe has a pretty solid history going back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years of Homo sapiens. Yeah.
Europe has a long chronology. Right. We've had the short chronology. And so I would say it makes sense for us to have quite a ample degree of skepticism to try to buy in and understand what we're looking at here.
Yeah.
But yes, I think that with growing evidence consistently in different geographical areas and different sources and different methods of dating, if they all point to the same thing, that's what's happening. For instance, you've got those footprints. There in New Mexico,
right
on the sands of, you know, that preserved situation there in that national monument.
Yeah.
And they've dated them several ways. I've read a couple of scientific articles so far on that. And another one, they feel very strongly that the evidence is there for in excess of 20,000 years ago, that there were people occupying New Mexico, and that's where those are from. And they've used radiocarbon dates, they've got stratigraphy, they've got everything else. But again, what is it? Extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. And so that's what we're looking at. And yes, I'm still waiting to see what other people really take from that piece of evidence. It seems rather compelling.
Yeah.
If what they say is true, and how they've dated it, and how they claim to have, you know, irrefutable evidence and dates that would support that particular age. I mean, that jumps from what we thought was literally maybe 13,000 to 21,000 years ago, like in an instant. And so someone says, well, where's the stuff in between? Right? Where's the archaeology that we should see between 13 and 21,000? Where's the people?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, there might be an argument for that too, because I've definitely interviewed some people on past shows that have discussed the fact that a lot of times we don't dig deep enough. You know what I mean? Because a lot of our evidence doesn't come from, you know, I mean, some of it comes from academic digs, you know, like some of the stuff up in Oregon, they're digging into these caves, and, you know, caves are very well-preserved environments, and you can come back year after year after year and just keep digging down in the cave, right? And it's a resource that just keeps on giving. But you talk about cultural resource management projects and shovel testing, and I'll tell you what, most of ours don't go down any deeper than you can reach with a shovel. And if it has to go down farther than that, sometimes we'll auger, but the standard rule, unless you know something different about the stratigraphy, the soils, the geochronology of the area, which a lot of times you don't, but if you know something different, then fine. But if you don't, you usually go down to two sterile levels, or the depth of the shovel, or the water table. But that doesn't always mean that that water table always really got me working in the Southeast. We'd always stop if we hit water. And I'm like, all right, well, the water table was different 10,000 years ago. It wasn't here. By stopping there, we're ignoring a huge body of evidence. You know what I mean?
So, for instance, in the area that I'm working in Oregon, in southwestern Oregon, near the town of Roseburg, there's a site that was excavated, and they excavated, I don't know, maybe 50, 100 centimeters, and then they stopped, but then they had an inkling that they may have been on top of a Mazama, you know, expression. They had to go 2 meters deeper than that to hit the cultural component below the Mazama ash. Can you imagine 2 meters?
That's
6 feet, right?
Yeah. That's a lot.
So the only reason they were able to get this is they had a column that was on the end of a ridge and they could see it. And so they were able to sort of get below that. And yes, there was a pre-Mazama expression that was there. Same thing happened in the Central Valley. They had a circumstance where they went down, I don't know, 10 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Then they hit the cultural expression. And it was a, you know, sort of a Western pluvial tradition material right there. And they dated it to 7,000-8,000 years ago. So if you had to go 10 feet to get to 7,000-8,000 years ago, can you imagine how deep you'd have to go?
Well, and this is what I'm talking about too, right? Like you get some of these areas. Now, out here in the Great Basin, you might go down 2 feet and hit bedrock, right? There's not a whole lot below the bedrock. If it's below the bedrock, you're done, right? But in some of these areas, like I'll never forget working out in the Carolinas and again, out on the coastal plain, you know, we're digging down to, you know, a meter at best, maybe a meter and a half if you can lay on your stomach and really reach your shovel down there. But then my wife worked on a project where they were, I don't know how they knew this, right? But by the time she got on it, they were augering down in this one area because there was something going in there. I think it was a reservoir project or something like that, but something was going in there. They were augering down and finding paleo deposits, like 8,000 to 10,000 year deposits at 3 to 4 meters below the surface, 3 to 4 meters. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, so you've got this evidence here of definite things, three to four meters down. Yeah. And yet we're stopping at a meter out here on the coast. And, you know, part of the reason out in that area is because the hurricanes and weather really shapes the landscape. And you can have a hurricane drop, 2 feet of sand on one area in a season. You know what I mean? So the landscape really adjusts quickly. So that's why you get buried deposits that could be incredibly deep in some areas, depending on the year, you know? So it's crazy. And yet we speak with authority when we say that's it.
Yeah. Right. So you're talking about the environment. We talk about cataclysms like Mount Mazama and the ash that fell 7,700 years ago. If you look in the Central Valley of California, you're looking at tremendous amounts of alluvium over the many years accumulating. And to get to anywhere near, let's say, Paleo-Indian, you'd have to go down 12, 15 feet to get to that deposit. So you're exactly right. So for a lot of us, we have never really gotten to that level, or we don't know where to find the exposure of the pale. You know, you want to see relic landforms where that was preserved so that you can find that kind of material.
You know,
that's exactly right.
In the past, I've called this regulatory bias, right? I don't know if that's a real term anybody uses, but, you know, when you're doing shovel testing or something like that, you only have to really look down as far as the disturbance is going to happen. You know, that's really the regulation. They're not asking you to find everything down to the lowest level, which is scientifically what we would want to do, but you're only being paid to go down as far as the ground will be disturbed, right? So if they're putting in a parking lot, you only have to go down 4 or 5 feet before you're going to hit soils they're just simply not going to disturb. So it's not that we're not saying there's something down there. We're just not being paid to find it. We're not given the opportunity.
Right. And it is regulatory bias. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good way of looking at it.
So it's crazy.
I guess the newest models have avoided regulatory bias. And now we're beginning to see a whole new set of expressions, both of a different archaeological tradition, chronologically and typologically, that is pre-Clovis, and may go between, let's say, 14 and maybe even 21,000 years ago. Mm. Now that 14 to 21 matches the genetic evidence, that they've been able to look at, the genetic sort of timeline that they've developed, looking right. at the peoples that they've examined, the indigenous peoples, and then examining their relationship and the time depth. So that's where they are. And I think that's a good place to stop. You could add your closing note, Doctor.
I will add to that, because there's one other thing besides the genetic evidence that starts giving that time depth, and that's the linguistic evidence, right? When they start looking at the sheer number of languages that Native Americans have just in North America alone, in order to gain that sort of variation, linguists can take that back thousands and thousands of years in what we knew of language evolution to say, well, you know, it would have to have gone back X number of years. And that time is getting pushed further and further back the more we study those languages and start realizing where the similarities and differences are. So, like you said, lots of evidence coming together pointing to a deeper history than we ever assumed.
I like it.
All right. Well, that's it for today then. Yeah.
Yep, that's it. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Hope you enjoyed this episode.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.